The next case today is United States v. Killian. Counsel ready? Okay. Appellant.
Good morning, Chief Judge Erdman, and may it please the Court. I am Captain John Legg, and I, along with my co-counsel, Lieutenant Colonel Joy Primoli, represent Appellant Airman First Class Allen G. Airman Killian was restrained with overpowering force as he explained...
Could you speak up a little?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Airman Killian was restrained with overpowering force as he exclaimed to professional medical staff and two military law enforcement professionals in an extremely intoxicated state. His conviction for provoking speech should be reversed for two reasons. First, no rational finder of fact could find that Airman Killian's words were likely to provoke the reasonable person to violence under these circumstances. Second, the military judge's instructions were deficient in that they misled the panel as to the element of provoking speech, citing an average person standard, vice a reasonable person, and failed to instruct on the occupation, education, and training of the listeners as a circumstance the fact finder should consider in evaluating whether Airman Killian's speech was provoking to a reasonable person. Now, Airman Killian found...
Counsel, before you start, on the instructional issue,
yes, Your Honor.
Why isn't the average reasonable prong of that argument waived? They litigated the other one, but... Why isn't the average reasonable prong waived? They didn't object to it. And when, more than they didn't object, this isn't forfeiture. They didn't object to it. When the judge came and said, I'm going to give this instruction, does anyone have anything to add to it? No, no. Are you satisfied with this instruction? Do you object to this instruction? No, no. That's affirmative waiver.
Your Honor, I would answer your question in two respects. First of all, appellant would suggest that the alternate instruction fairly embraced the issue of the reasonable versus average. And second of all, at minimum, this court has held where it refers to descriptions on an element, a military judge has a sua sponte duty to instruct accurately. Thirdly, so I suppose three prongs, Your Honor, I said two. At very best for the government's position, which I do not believe that they argue that it is waiver, but at very best it would be forfeiture for failure to timely assert a right. There's no
evidence. Well, why is it forfeiture when they said no, no to a direct question from the district, from the military judge?
Well, Your Honor, I think that direct general question did not specifically address this average versus reasonable distinction, and so
they have a duty to raise it. The judge doesn't have a duty to tell them what to do.
Well, Your Honor, with regard to elements of an offense, the judge actually has, it is appellant's position, a sua sponte duty to instruct accurately. And as this court, as the MCM specifically states, it clearly states in plain language terms.
Well, and where does the statute use the reasonable man standard? I mean, what are the elements of the offense?
That the accused wrongfully used words toward a certain person, that the words were provoking or reproachful, and that the person's words were used towards a person subject to the code. And this court, and I believe...
I don't see an element that says anything about average versus reasonable.
Well, the case law that has revolved around the provoking element, and certainly the definition in the MCM, states that provoking and reproachful are those words that are used in the presence of whom they are directed at, and those which a reasonable person would expect to induce a breach of the peace.
So you're referring to the manual definition, not the statute.
Yes, Your Honor, and the case law that explains what the elements are, specifically relying on that portion of the manual. And I believe every case, at least that the parties have cited, has articulated that element as a reasonable person standard. I'm not aware of any case law, and I do not believe that the...
Well, I'm not concerned with the distinction between reasonable and average. I'm concerned with whether the issue is waived.
Absolutely, Your Honor, and for the three reasons that I suggested, it's our position that it was not.
Thank you.
Moving, I'd like to start first on the sufficiency of the record, because the evidence here is quite unique in that the words that were uttered in an isolated place in the trauma ward of a military treatment facility in Osan Air Base, Korea. It was not in the presence of the general public, such as this court, the circumstances this court relied on in Davis. And it was uttered in the presence of two sets of people. The first set, military law enforcement professionals, are individuals that this court and subordinate courts have said have their special training should generally indicate where they're restrained that they will not be provoked under these circumstances. The second set of people, the medical professionals, there were three alleged victims in this instance that were all active duty members. All of those people testified at trial that they had extensive training as medical professionals and that they specifically had instruction, either formal or on the job, with regard to handling belligerent patients, and they isolated this patient in a trauma bay where it was traditional to handle belligerent patients, so they were acting in accordance with their training.
Well, what exactly does that have to do with the standard that is in the manual that you just referenced, which is what a reasonable person would expect to induce a breach of the peace? So where are we inserting the reasonable person here? We're not looking at the individuals who are actually there. We're looking at a reasonable person. And it seems to me that we can either put the reasonable person in the place of those people or we can put the reasonable person viewing the circumstances. So which of those, if either of them?
Well, Your Honor, I think the definition in the manual, it does recite the reasonable person standard, and I think that we have to look to the common law and what components of a reasonable person would adopt circumstances of the situation. And I believe it's well established, at least in the realm of tort law, which we cited in our brief, that if an actor has skills or knowledge that exceed those possessed by most others, these skills or knowledge are circumstances to be taken into account in the reasonable person standard.
Well, do we have to go to tort law? Why don't we just look at that language, which a reasonable person would expect to induce a breach under the circumstances? So it seems to me under the circumstances is kind of the key word here. And as I understood your argument, under the circumstances includes the experience, the setting, the education, and all of that. And is that your argument?
Your Honor, I think that you can look at it both ways, and either lens that you look it through, I believe the evidence is legally insufficient. But certainly the under the circumstances prong indicates that there needs to be some inquiry into who the listeners are, as courts in Thompson and Davis and Shropshire have looked at. And so even if we don't need to look so far as what the common law of the reasonable person standard, which of course is quite well developed, and I don't believe any court has had the particular occasion to talk about special skills outside the context of a police officer. But in Adams, this court, in answering a certified question from the Navy TJAG, specifically was asked whether it was error to rely on the occupational training of the victim, and it did not specifically reference the police officer in the issue presented, and this court held that it was not error, and that was, as Chief Judge Urban, you stated, a circumstance that must be considered by the finder of fact.
Well, you can't have it both ways. You're arguing for the reasonable man standard. Fair enough. Reasonable person. Fair enough. And then you don't want a reasonable person. You want a reasonable physician, or you want a reasonable cop. Which is it?
Your Honor, I think that the reasonable person standard, the common law has established that...
I don't want to hear about tort law. I want to hear about criminal liability. I want to hear about legal sufficiency.
Your Honor,
is tort law all you have to argue?
No. Your Honor, I think that when you look at the way these cases have examined the facts, they've referred to the reasonable guard or, in Adams, the occupational training of the victim. And so, in effect, these courts are saying that you do look to the training of the person under the circumstances.
Are there any cases that involve anything other than law enforcement personnel?
Your Honor, actually, I believe it's not explicitly discussed by the court, but I believe it's in Thompson. There is a physician that is present with the stockade guard in that situation. And the court primarily discussed the standard of provoking a reasonable guard, but the facts of that case also demonstrate that the reason the person uttered the provoking words is he was being asked to get up and present himself for an inspection by a physician who was also present at the time. That's the closest I can get specifically, Your Honor, with military criminal case law, of course.
We discussed the policeman aspect of it.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's
Thank
correct,
you.
That primarily the rationale in that case
right.
is based on the training.
Okay.
Absolutely.
But that's the only thing you can cite to, is that one small aspect of Thompson. You can't cite to any other case, federal case, state case, where this has been extended to something other than law enforcement officers?
Well, of course, provoking speech and gestures is a uniquely military offense, and so that the history of this, as discussed in Thompson and Davis, appears to date back all the way to the era of Richard I and was designed to prevent the troops from getting involved in fights or duels, and so...
But in terms of fighting words, generally?
Your Honor, I can't cite to a specific case that adopts the settled common law that's articulated in the restatement, that when you're talking about a reasonable person and evaluating... So, for example, let's say that through some extraordinary circumstance, the physician violated his Hippocratic oath and did react in a retaliatory manner and was sued. He would be held to the standard of care of a doctor, setting aside any Ferries issues or anything.
So you're
like
going
that.
Back to torts?
Yes, Your Honor. I think what I'm going back to is not specifically, I mean, this reasonable person standard, I think primarily started with the case of Vaughn versus Manlove, which was a tort case and has been extended since then. But if you look to the military cases that have relied on the professional training of a police officer, they refer to a reasonable guard, or specifically in Adams, they talk about occupational training of the victim. And so that rationale is not explicitly limited to that of an officer.
Isn't that standard at odds, though, with the language in the manual, which is what a reasonable person would expect to induce? And you're saying, I think, that our prior cases, and your argument is that we should look at a reasonable medical person, not a reasonable person looking at these circumstances.
No, Your Honor, what I'm saying is if the circumstances demonstrate that the entire audience are medical professionals, then consistent with the restatement and also consistent with the language of the manual, that's a circumstance that is important. And I think that also relates to my second argument regarding the instructional error, that the military judge in this case refused to instruct that the occupational training of the listeners in an isolated setting, unlike Davis, where the listeners were the general public in the enlisted club. Here, we're talking about all police officers or all medical professionals in an isolated trauma ward. So those circumstances were ones that the finder of fact should have been instructed that they should take into account in evaluating what a reasonable person, whether they would be provoked under those circumstances. And so, for example, if an appellant came up to a physician in a bar, not in a treatment setting, I think that the situation would be quite different. But when we're talking about a treatment setting where everyone agrees that the sole purpose of the presence of the accused in this instance was to receive treatment, that professional training was extremely salient. And the military judge refused to instruct the panel that they should consider that, and then the trial counsel, enabled by that instruction, argued that that should be disregarded. And basically what the military judge did was enable a situation where the panel believed that they could disregard this evidence when the element specifically says a reasonable person under the circumstances.
Is it your position that the case should go back for a retrial based on proper instructions, or are you saying that as a matter of law on these facts and this record, we should enter direct an acquittal?
Your Honor, I think that both issues, I think the answer is depending on the issue that is dispositive for the court. And so if the court reviews the record and the significant restraint that was imposed upon impellant and decides, consistent with Shropshire and Thompson, that where you have both an entire audience of professionals and police officers and significant restraint employed, that record, under these facts, is legally insufficient.
Well, the reason I ask that is because generally, this reasonable person standard, and I know you're asking for something a little bit different, a reasonable physician in the circumstances in which these doctors found themselves, but generally that's a jury question, the standard of whether or not someone is a reasonable person under the circumstances. So why shouldn't this case go back to the members for a new trial?
Your Honor, if this court deems the evidence legally sufficient, which we do not concede that it is, but if this court resolves the issue on the jury instruction, then a properly instructed panel would need to consider the evidence. And so it would be an opportunity for this court to note the instructional error that we've identified, the average versus reasonable person. Your Honor, I see that my time has expired. May I briefly conclude and answer?
I have one question. I actually have two questions. Number one question, what if he hadn't been restrained and had physically attacked the physicians?
Your Honor, if he had physically attacked the physicians, of course they would have been authorized to use self-defense.
Mm-hmm. And I think would that have provoked an affray?
Well, we might also find a situation where provoking gestures were charged, which they were not in this situation.
Right, because he couldn't gesture.
And I don't think anybody contends that the evidence was legally insufficient to support a charge of drunken disorderly conduct.
Well, you conceded that, didn't you?
Pardon?
You conceded that, didn't you?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Right. A question two is that, have you abandoned your contention that this speech is constitutionally protected?
Your Honor, in that regard, I would simply rest on the pleadings that we've submitted.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, Your Honor, I respectfully reserve my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Government?
May it please the Court. I am Major Meredith Steer, and along with Colonel Catherine Oler, we represent the United States in this case. This Court should affirm appellant's rightful conviction for using provoking speech towards two officers and an NCO because there was ample evidence from which a rational trier of fact could have found each element of the offense beyond a reasonable doubt. There is no question that appellant was the one who used the language at issue here, or that the three people that appellant yelled at for nearly 3 hours were subject to the code. There is also no question that a reasonable person who yells one of the most vulgar terms in the English language towards a female officer who was attempting to help him would expect to induce the breach of the peace. Appellant argues in his brief that a violent act like attacking appellant could not have been expected in these circumstances. But as noted by AFCA, a breach of the peace includes other disturbances. And indeed, if you consider the MCM definition of breach of the peace, located under the article directly preceding Article 117, you will see that loud speech and unruly conduct may constitute a breach of the peace. The MCM is clear that a breach of the peace is acts or conduct which disturb the peace, the public tranquility, or impinge upon the peace and good order to which the community is entitled.
Could you define breach of the peace in plain language, plain English, rather than all of these legal sites? It seems that our cases have said there should be some violence attached to it.
Violence or turbulent acts, which is what the military judge instructed the members in this case. So it's not just violence, but any type of turbulent act. And I would say that the manual has defined right there what a breach of the peace is. It's something that's affecting the good order and discipline of the military. And that's indeed, as this court has stated in several cases, part of the purpose behind Article 117 is to allow members of the military to interact without fear that somebody may say something to them that would provoke some type of response.
And do you think in a situation like this where an individual is restrained that whether it's medical professionals or whether it's just about anybody, whatever they said is going to cause people to assault them while they are restrained?
I think when you consider the fact that this went on for nearly 3 hours, and if you look at the testimony on the record that those comments were made for the entire period of time, and that the restraint ultimately ended with medical sedation in order to end this scenario here.
Well, I think that the sedation was to enable them to get a blood test. I don't think there was any testimony that the sedation was to end the ranting.
Correct, Your Honor. However, part of what the appellant was doing was thrashing around and yelling whenever somebody tried to treat him, particularly the Asian or Koreans who came over to try to treat him. In fact, Staff Sergeant KB said that he had to back away at one point and was told to back away. So I think restraint is one of the things that the members in this case rightly considered, and even knowing that appellant was restrained in this scenario, they, as the rational trier of fact, still found that appellant had used provoking speech in this case. So,
in fact, restraints cause fake courage on the part of the listener? If someone is restrained, might they perhaps be more likely to take action against the speaker who's using provoking language?
I think certainly that's a possibility. And I think there's been several cases where this court has, in Davis, the military courts have upheld convictions when somebody was restrained under the circumstances. And one of those cases was U.S. versus Ybarra, which the United States provided a supplemental cite to this court for.
Well, what are we looking at here? Are we looking at the reasonable medical professional as we used to look at the, or and still do look at the reasonable police officer?
Your Honor, I think that appellant is using reasonable in the wrong spot of the argument here. We're not talking about the reasonable listener. We're talking about a reasonable person observing everything that was going on in this circumstance. Would they have expected appellant's speech to induce a breach of the peace?
And when they look at everything in this circumstance, are they looking at the fact that these are medical professionals in an emergency room?
Your Honor, I think that the reasonable person standard would take into account something that can be easily observed. But where it goes into circumstances such as the subjective beliefs of these medical professionals or the subjective specific training that some of them may or may not have had.
Well, that's not subjective. Either they had the training or they didn't. And what's the record on that point?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, could you repeat that?
What does the record show with respect to whether or not these medical professionals had the requisite training?
Your Honor, the record shows that two of the medical professionals who were the named victims in this case, Captain J.K. and Staff Sergeant K.B. had some training in dealing with disorderly patients. But the other captain named in the specification, Captain MS, had no training in dealing with patients like this.
Major Steer, having gone down the road of finding an exception with respect to reasonableness as it applies to police officers, how do we reconcile this case? I mean, where do we draw the line so that we're consistent with respect to the case law? It seems to me that with respect to medical professionals, you can make the argument that they, too, have a certain heightened insensitivity to these kinds of acts in the context of the trauma in which they found themselves. So why doesn't that apply in this context?
Well, Your Honor, I think if you go back and carefully examine the police officer cases, and particularly if you read the concurring opinion in U.S. v. Davis, the concurring judge there points out that it might be taking it too far to say that we have a different standard for police officers. Each of those cases was fact-determined based on the type of restraint, and then, so in Thompson, for example, the guard had a jail cell door blocking him and the appellant in that case. So Davis points out that it's not really the fact that these are police officers that we're concerned with. You're considering the words that are spoken and what effect they are likely to have on the listener.
Is that the Davis concurrence or the Davis majority that points that out?
Your Honor, it is the concurring opinion. However, the Davis majority, it just didn't go as far as a concurring opinion, but the Davis majority still upheld the conviction in that case.
Should we repeal those cases, the police officer cases?
No, Your Honor. And it's not the United States' position that those cases need to be repealed. It's simply that you...
They should not be expanded.
Absolutely, Your Honor, and I think it goes too far to say that there is a separate standard for police officers. A police officer, using a member's common knowledge and or common sense and knowledge of ways of the world when they're on a panel, they know that a police officer has some training in dealing with disorderly people. And in fact, when you're looking at a drunken, disorderly person who is being arrested, I think in Shropshire, that's where the Air Force Court said, that's to be expected, that a drunk person, when you're in the midst of arresting him, is possibly going to say some things to you.
Wouldn't that hold true for a reasonable individual in a emergency room and a reasonable medical personnel who deals with drunken people every Friday and Saturday night?
No, Your Honor, and actually if you look at the record and the testimony in this case, all three of the medical professionals testified that while they had come across drunk people in the ER, that they had never heard anything like this. So in 5 years of experience, Captain MS said that she had never heard anything like this in an emergency room, and that's at the Joint Appendix on page 85. Additionally, Staff Sergeant AV and Staff Sergeant RM testified about the scenario.
So how far are we getting in from the government's perspective to what the individuals, the medical professionals, believed at that time? You're now quoting as to what they did and what they thought. Are we to look at that completely? Are we to look at their testimony to say that they never even thought that this would provoke them to violence?
Well, Your Honor, on that point, if I were the trial counsel, I probably would have objected as to relevance on that. But I think you can use that in comparing that to a police officer scenario where they commonly are arresting drunk and disorderly people, and people are commonly saying nasty things back to police officers. That is not the case when you're dealing with drunk and disorderly.
It's not the case because the record doesn't support it. What if the record supported the notion that these hospital physicians dealt with this kind of activity all the time? Do we have a different case?
Potentially we do have a different case.
So isn't that, it seems to me that it's not a question of law. It depends on the facts and circumstances of the case.
It absolutely depends.
So the problem then is the instructional error. Right? Because if the jury wasn't, the members weren't properly instructed, how are they to arrive at that result, at the correct result?
Well, Your Honor, the United States believes that the members were absolutely properly instructed under the law in this case. Appellant makes a big deal about this average quote, so I want to take you to the seminal case, the very first case on fighting words, which is where provoking speech is derived, and that's Chaplinsky versus New Hampshire. And the Supreme Court stated in that case, the test is what men of common intelligence would understand would be words likely to cause an average addressee to fight. And that's Chaplinsky at 315 U.S. 572. So that's where the average man comes from. And if you think about it, if you were to apply a reasonable listener would never attack somebody. a reasonable listener would take a step back and call in a mediator. You can't apply a reasonable person standard to the listener, because the entire point of Article 117 is to deter somebody like the appellant in this case from making such insulting words. And so what standard do we use? We use an average one, which is actually beneficial to appellant. It doesn't have to be the average person. But that is what Chaplinsky has said. It's what you would expect of an average person. And that is the instruction.
How is that beneficial to appellant, the point you're making?
Well, I mean, we were talking about tort law earlier. You could have an eggshell plaintiff sitting as your addressee, and if anybody were upset by the words that you used to them, even if you didn't expect that they were that reproachful and that person attacked you, then that's how it's helpful to appellant, Your Honor. It's the average person. It's not the eggshell plaintiff, and it's not the person who would withstand anything that you would say to them. Because
that sounds like it's also not the police officer. So what are we supposed to do with our cases?
Well, Your Honor, in the police officer cases, it was not determinant that they were police officers, and that's it. There are cases that upheld that when you say language to a police officer, that can still be considered provoking speech. U.S. v. Davis is one of those scenarios where the words hurled were in the direction of the police officer and about the police officer, and that was upheld by this court. So it doesn't matter whether it's a police officer or not. That's just one of the circumstances to consider.
So you want us to look at the reasonable person in the shoes of the person making the statements. Would a reasonable person making these statements believe that they would provoke violence?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that's exactly what the MCM says. But I don't know that it's so much the appellant that you want to put yourself in the shoes of. You're just the reasonable person observing everything that's going on. And okay. I think that's
consistent with the law. And that's different, I think. That's a little bit different.
Yes, Your Honor. And the only reason I say you're putting yourself, or I tended to agree with you there, is that you don't care what the intent of appellant was or how drunk he was, that he had, wouldn't have said this had he not been so drunk. We don't care what appellant was doing. We're looking at what the reasonable person would expect by his words.
So when you refer then in the code to the circumstances, in this particular case, what are the circumstances? Is it only that he was going on for 3 hours, that he was very verbally abusive, that the language was completely vile? Are there any other circumstances that you are saying in this particular case the panel members should have considered in deciding this matter?
No, Your Honor. I think the panel members considered all of those factors and more that were beneficial to appellant, because the trial counsel did not object to a lot of the defense counsel's, and actually I think the trial counsel in a few places elicited training. So the members heard all of this evidence, and then the military judge instructed them to, under the facts and circumstances, he specifically said, consider the facts and circumstances. And then when trial defense counsel argued, 17 pages of the record, 8 pages of those was spent on the provoking speech. And during that argument, he brought up all of the training of the medical professionals. He brought up the fact that the appellant was restrained. He brought up all of these beneficial factors. And the members, still considering all of the facts and circumstances of the case, found that appellant was guilty of using provoking speech.
What are we to make of the trial counsel's argument that the members could ignore the medical training, all of that, because all you're dealing with is the average person? That seems to be a misstatement of the law.
And, Your Honor, I think if you go back and you read the entire argument, there was one spot where he seemed to really indicate that, and that was in his rebuttal, but I don't think when you look at the overall argument, it went that far. I also am not sure that whether trial counsel's argument was proper or not is before this court. And whether that is a problem under the law. I think potentially the court can consider it if you're even going to reach a prejudice analysis here, and whether that was a prejudice to appellant. However, at the end of the day, the military judge gave the appropriate instruction to the members, including that trial counsel and defense counsel arguments are just arguments. They're not evidence. And the military judge is the one who's instructing on the law. And so we have to presume that the members in this case followed the military judge's instruction and not trial counsel's argument. I would like to briefly address just some of the prongs here of whether, if you go into whether the military judge should have given defense counsel's instruction, and again, that's D'Amato versus Oliveira stated out the standard that this court should look at, and that's first whether the instruction that trial defense counsel proposed was correct. If the law was uncertain at the time, as it is now, then how could the instruction have been correct? But then as you go through defense counsel's instruction, there are certain parts of it that I would say are absolutely inaccurate and favor the evidence in favor of the defense. And this court knows that a military judge should not be giving instructions that favor the evidence of one party over the other. And the court then would move on to whether this is substantially covered in the main charge. These facts and circumstances were covered in the main charge, and finally, defense was able to put forward their theory of the case without any restraint. And the members still, as a rational trier of fact, found appellant guilty in this case. And, Your Honor, also to your point, defense counsel did not object at all to trial counsel's argument when he was using the instruction in that way. So if there are no further questions, may I briefly conclude? Taking the evidence in the light most favorable to the prosecution, appellant's conviction for using provoking speech must be affirmed because a reasonable trier of fact could and did find all of the elements beyond a reasonable doubt. The members were properly instructed to consider all the facts and circumstances, and trial defense counsel argued at length about the facts and circumstances and that they amounted to reasonable doubt. The members disagreed. Therefore, the instructions were not deficient, and this court should affirm appellant's conviction. Thank you.
Rebuttal? Your Honor, a few points on rebuttal. First of all, with regard to the training of the third victim, Staff Sergeant QB, on the record at Joint Appendix 108, there's discussion of mandatory CAP training that Sergeant KB received, and elsewhere in the record, Captain JK talks about giving this training, about working in an emergency room and dealing with patient interaction. And so I think it's inaccurate to say that Sergeant KB did not have training as reflected in the record. Second, the government wishes to bring to this court evidence of subjective beliefs as long as they are favorable to the government, in terms of whether someone was offended or whether they had seen something like this happen before, but wishes to disregard the evidence when we talk about something that is much more objective, which, as Judge Diaz pointed out, is the training of the people that were the listeners of the words. In addition, with respect to the argument of trial counsel, any objection after the instruction had been offered would have been completely ineffectual and would have been detrimental to the defense's case, because the defense had already asked for the judge to instruct the members that they should consider training, and the judge had refused. The judge's conclusion that the law was not settled is not controlling. As this court said in Adams, considering the occupational training of a victim is not error. So the judge was incorrect when he said that the law was not settled in that regard. He could have and should have instructed on the occupational training of the listener. So,
but you just said, counsel, that it would have been detrimental to the accused for the objection to be made. Why would it be detrimental to the accused?
If he had objected at the point where in rebuttal, where he had no opportunity to reply at that point, if he had objected and said, you're saying to disregard the training of the listener, and the judge overruled it and gave the same charge based on his prior discussion, that would have been detrimental in front of the members to appellant's case. And so we can't, although this is not an argument of counsel case, the argument is evidence of prejudice because the inaccurate instructions were used to the detriment of appellant, and he did not have the opportunity to respond to them. As Judge Diaz pointed out, if the fact finder had been properly instructed, perhaps we would be talking with regard to the second issue about something different. But we don't know what a rational panel properly instructed would have ruled because they were not given the opportunity. If there are no further questions from the panel, I respectfully rest on the pleadings.
Thank you. The court thanks the parties for their arguments. The court is adjourned until further order of the court.